Heute in der Rubrik Krimi, William Gibson, Spook Country. Erschienen vorerst nur auf Englisch im Verlag Viking 2007.
William Gibson, Kanadier, Jahrgang 48, ist in der schriftstellerisch beneidenswerten Situation Mitte der 80er Jahre in seinem ersten Roman Neuromancer, eine Technologie, den Cyberspace literarisch zu erfinden, diese schon 10 Jahre später Realität werden zu sehen, um 25 Jahre später Alltag geworden zu sein. Dass sich in der Cyberspace-Trilogie oder Sprawl-Trilogy, wie sie im Englischen heißt, und zu der neben Neuromancer noch die Romane Count Zero und Mona Lisa Overdrive gehören, die Protagonisten Kabel in den Kopf stecken, um die Rotlichtbezirke der virtuellen Realität zu besurfen, und dass damit das Paradigma des weltweiten Webs ziemlich genau verkehrt herum prognostiziert wurde, denn nicht wir begeben uns täglich in eine nicht zu greifende Realität, sie kommt auf allen Medien gleichzeitig zu uns, geschenkt. Das tut dem Nimbus des Visionärs, der Gibson umgibt, keinen Abbruch. Nach einigen Romanen in ähnlichem Sujet wie die Cyberspace-Trilogie las man von Gibson im Jahr 2003 mit Pattern Recognition einen Cyberspace-Roman für 40 Seiten, um dann erstaunt festzustellen, dass alles, was dort geschrieben steht, technisch schon lange da ist und einfach nur implementiert werden muss, was 2 Jahre später dann auch geschah und heute YouTube heißt. Ein solcher Überraschungseffekt erwischt einen natürlich nur einmal, und so liest man den gerade erschienenen Roman Spook Country. Spook steht im Englischen sowohl für Agenten à la CIA und KGB, wie auch für Geister und Gespenster, ständig ein wenig auf der Suche nach dem kommenden großen Ding. Das lässt nicht lange auf sich warten und bringt zunächst die Rückkehr des guten alten VR-Helms, mit dem man in den 90ern in Spielhallen für ein paar Euro Cyberspace spielen konnte. Allerdings mit einem Twist. Der Visor in Spook Country überlagert die reale Welt mit computergenerierten Bildern, die sich den Änderungen im Blickwinkel anpassen. Wie Geisterbilder, von denen nur Sehende, die mit dem Helm wissen. So liegt beim Blick durch den Visor der halbtote River Phoenix in L.A. vor der Bar auf dem Gehsteig, wie am 31. Oktober 1993. Oder ein Zimmer füllt sich mit wogenden Getreidefeldern, wohin und aus welchem Winkel man auch blickt, hat man den Helm auf. Wo neue Technologien entstehen, stehen natürlich die üblichen Verdächtigen als erstes auf der Matte. Nicht das Militär, das sind ja nicht die 80er, nein die Werbe- und PR-Industrie. Diese spielte schon in Pattern Recognition, Gibsons vorletzten Roman, eine Hauptrolle und sorgt auch hier wieder für den Kontrast zwischen Arm und Reich und bietet Stoff, dem Wort Globalisierung ein paar Highlights auf das zottelige Attack-Image zu legen. Man fühlt sich gerade als deutscher Leser sofort zu Hause, denn die vom KGB ausgebildete kubanisch-chinesische Kleinkriminellenfamilie beseitigt ihre Spuren mit einem teuer aussehenden Staubsauger aus Deutschland und deren jüngere Mitglieder tragen Adidas-Schuhe, Spezialanfertigung für die GSG 9, German Counterterrorism Squad. Der Medienmogul fährt einen customized Maybach und der Rest seiner Fahrzeugflotte besteht aus Phaetons, denn diese gehen so schön unauffällig fast als VW Passats durch. Wir Deutsche sind wieder wer. Der Plot des Buches ist durchaus okay, aber deshalb muss man Spook Country nicht wirklich lesen. Der Sound ist es, der das Buch wunderbar macht. Nicht jeder wird wissen, dass eine WLAN-Verschlüsselung WEP heißt und dass ein Trio ein Handy mit viel zu vielen Knöpfen ist. Aber das ungehemmte Verwenden dieser Begriffe ist gerade das Raffinierte, denn niemand versteht beim Schauen von Star Trek, wie ein Warp-Antrieb funktioniert und was passiert, wenn die Deuteronium-Kammer leer läuft. Aber jeder ahnt, das ist Hightech, so könnte es sein. Bei Gibson nun liest man von ähnlichen Begriffen, begibt sich dann im ganz realen Cyberspace auf google.com und bemerkt beim Eintippen jener Begriffe, dass es ausnahmslos alle futuristisch klingenden Technologien und Marken im Buch tatsächlich gibt und dass die lakonisch einsame Jahreszahl auf der ersten Seite des Buches nicht das Jahr ist, in dem Spook Country entstanden ist, sondern in dem es spielt. Und das ist verdammt spooky.
Knelt and tightened the laces of his Adidas GSG9s, respectfully reminding the Gereros that it was time. He stood, flexed his toes, crossed 14th Street, and started up through the park, his hand on the iPod in its plastic bag in his jacket pocket. Juana, once in Havana, had taken him into a building of great and utterly decayed grandeur, though in those days he had had no idea that a structure of such age and intricacy might be found in any other condition. In the foyer, continents and oceans of distempered plaster were mapped on the walls and ceilings. The elevator had shaken and screeched, carrying them to the top floor, and as Juana had heaved the cage-like metal door open, Tito had abruptly become aware of the drums he must have been hearing for some time, perhaps since they had first entered this street in Dragones. As they waited at the tall doors of the floor's single apartment, Tito had read and reread the handwritten message in Spanish on a grease-flecked slip of brown paper fastened to the door with four thickly rusted carpet tacks. "Enter in the spirit of God and Jesus Christ, or do not enter." Tito had looked up at Juana, raising his eyebrows in some question he wasn't quite able to form. It might well have said Marx and Lenin, Juana had told him. The door had been opened by a tall woman in a scarlet headscarf, a lit cigar in her hand, who smiled broadly to see them and reached out to touch Tito's head. Later, beneath the portrait of Our Lady of Guadalupe and another of Che Guevara, the tall woman had begun the dance of the walking dead, and Tito, pressed close to Juana, squinting through the fumes of cigars and sweet aftershave, had watched as bare feet softly slapped the ruined parquet. The guerreros were around him now, talking among themselves in a language like weather, like high, fast clouds. He shivered within his jacket and walked on through the sunlight toward the bare trees with their green buds. Oshosi, showing him dead spots in the square's human matrix, figures that were no part of the unconscious dance formed here by this clearing amid the long city's buildings. He didn't look directly at those pretenders, watchers. He adjusted his path, avoiding them. When he was closer to the canvas stalls of the market, he saw the old man, moving slowly along between displays of vegetables, his long tweed coat open to the warmth of the day. He walked now with a bright metal cane and seemed to have some difficulty with his leg. Oshosi rounded suddenly, sliding into Tito like a wind, dry and unexpectedly warm, showing him the convergence of the watchers. The nearest was a tall, broad-shouldered man with sunglasses and a blue baseball cap, doing a poor job of pretending to stroll casually in the direction of the old man, an S of tension marking his brow between the glasses and the cap. Tito felt the two behind him as if Oshi were pushing his thumbs into his back. He adjusted his course, making it plain that he was headed for the old man. He slowed, and making a show of squaring his shoulders, hoping the men behind him would read and respond to this lie of the body. He saw the lips of the man with the sunglasses move, and remembered what the one in Prada had said about their radios. Sistema was in each fall of his black Adidas, pulling the iPod from his pocket, held in the open plastic bag, not touching it with his fingers. He was almost there, the Prada man's 10 paces, but black glasses was a mere 3 from the old man when the old man pivoted gracefully, whipping the cane up and sideways at arm's length into the side of black glasses' neck. Tito saw the S of tension erased from the man's brow as the cane struck, and for what seemed far too long there was a face that consisted only of 3 holes beneath the visor of the blue baseball cap. The twin voids of the sunglasses and equally round and seemingly toothless black hole of a mouth. Then the man struck the sidewalk like something deboned, the loaded cane clattering heavily beside him, and Tito felt their hands on his shoulders and stopped moving forward. "Thief!" cried the old man with great force, his voice ringing out. "Thieves!" Tito back-tucked as the followers' momentum carried them past him. As he came down, Oshosi showed him his elegant cousin Marcos, smiling urbanely between 2 handsome displays of produce, and straightening from having recovered something from between the wooden sawhorses of a farmer's stand. A length of wood, Marcos gripping it firmly at either end with gloved hands, his feet braced, as a trio of men running in the direction of the old man seemed to strike an invisible wall, and then to fly through it, becoming airborne. One landed on a farmer's display, and women began to scream. Marcos tossed the wooden handle of the tripwire down, as if discovering it fouled with filth, and strolled away. The 2 men who had been following Tito, realizing he was behind them now, spun in unison, their shoulders colliding. The heavier of the 2 was slapping at something on his neck. Tito saw the wires of a radio. "Red team won," the man declared furiously, with a savage and inexplicable emphasis on whatever victory that might be, then lunged for Tito, shoving his companion out of his way to do so. Tito was having to feint, as if panicking, in various directions in order to provide these 2 with the illusion of almost capturing him. Seeing the clumsiness of the one reaching for him, he decided that any more deliberate miming of fumbling and losing the iPod would be wasted. He dropped it directly in the man's path, a square of white plastic separating as it struck the pavement. He pretended to lunge for it, in order to underline the fact that it was there. His would-be captor, seeing it, reflexively batted him aside. Rolling with the blow, Tito came up running as the heavier man dove for the iPod. His companion tried to block Tito with a move he might have remembered from American football. Tito somersaulted between his legs and kicked off, on what must have been one of the man's Achilles tendons, to judge by his sharp yelp of pain. Tito ran south, away from the intersection of 17th and Park, his destination. Past the one from the Prada store shoe department, in a tradesman's paint-splashed overalls, in one hand a yellow box with 3 short black antennas. Around Tito ran the Orishas, panting like vast dogs, scout and opener, opener and clearer, and Osun, whose role was mystery.